Last case, it's 10-1886, Toledo Bar Association versus David Roman Files, Jr. Mr. Wisniewski?
That's correct. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'd like to take 12 minutes of my time, split the 15 minutes, 3 minutes to Mr. Files. My name is Marshall Wisniewski, and I do represent Mr. Files in this case. I would like to indicate to the court that all references are to the rules of professional conduct until I would note otherwise. The reason that discipline should not be imposed upon the respondent in this case is because the relator has failed to show each and every element of the claimed violations by clear and convincing evidence. This court, under the disciplinary procedure, is the final determiner of the facts of this case. And I think you're going to find that as you go through all the evidence, you're going to find that the evidence that was presented in this case was not to that standard. And the first violation that I would like to address is that relative to the Rule 1.8E and the 8.4A violations that relate to the loans that were made. Now, the only evidence that we have in this case is that the loans were merely arranged by Mr. Files.
Is it your position that arranging loans with a spouse creates no conflict of interest? Is that the basis of why you say there's no violation?
In this case, the answer is yes. And the reason that I say that is because there was no conflict of interest. And if you
How can there be no conflict of interest when your spouse is giving a loan and repayment of that loan is going to impact your spouse, impact your income, impact so many things that you have an interest in?
Well, I think that the court should review the testimony of Deborah Myers or Orlando and Mr. Ron Hofstetler, and their testimony shows that when I ask the question, is Mrs. Files a yes person, and would she do what Mr. Files asked her to do without making her own determination? The answer was no. She was not a yes woman.
So if you have a spouse that is a little more independent, that removes the conflict of interest? Is that what you're saying?
If
I am my own woman and my husband doesn't tell me what to do, then I can give loans to his clients because he's not going to tell me what to do, even though the interest inures to me or the repayment may never come and my finances are impacted, but it doesn't have any conflict? Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what we're saying. And
is that a rule of law that we should apply to all attorney spouse loans, to look at what type of relationship the husband and wife have to determine whether there's a conflict? Is that the rule of law we should write on this case?
No. What I think should happen is that this court, by its decision, should provide clear guidance to the legal community. If you take a look at Rule 1.
Would clear guidance be you don't have your spouse involved with your client in loan transactions because that is an inherent conflict on its face? Would that be a much clearer rule than looking at every single relationship between a husband and wife to determine if there was an actual conflict?
Well, I think that's the purpose of the rules. First is to help us determine whether there's a conflict, and that's where I think the evidence in this case does not disclose to a clear...
Counsel, who set up the loan? I mean, who introduced the spouse to the clients that received the money?
It was Mr. Files.
And didn't Mr. Files write a promissory note?
Did he draft it?
Well, prepare it or
yes, he did.
Well, who was he representing at that time?
He was
the lender or the borrower?
He was representing his wife, Joanne Files.
So in this circumstance, he has a client that he's representing in one piece of litigation, and during the course of that litigation, he gets another client that he's representing who's a lender to his client. And you think that's not a conflict?
No, and the reason that I don't is because there's absolutely nothing that shows that Mr. Robinson himself ever thought that Mr. Files represented him regarding the loan transaction. And that's where I think the key to
Well, did he disclose to his client, I'm representing my wife here and I'm not representing you?
Yes. And there's documentary evidence on the closing statements which shows that, in fact, he was representing his wife. But the other key is the representation.
Didn't he have to pursue litigation to collect some of these loans?
Yes, he did. But I think the key to the determination of the conflict lies in the representation agreement itself. It says that Mr. Files only represented Mr. Robinson regarding the Royal Homes litigation, and that if Mr. Robinson wanted any other services or if there were any other services to be delivered, that there would have to be a written addendum to the agreement. And number one, there was none. But number two, if you read Mr. Robinson's grievance, he does not claim that Mr. Files ever represented him regarding the note transaction. He only says that Mr. Files represented him regarding Royal Homes. If you take a look at the fact that he was representing the two clients but regarding different matters, you then have to go into the Rule 1.7 A and B analysis to determine whether or not there is a direct adversity or whether there is a substantial risk. And in this case, there was neither. But the problem with the decision that we got out of the panel was they did not do a Rule 1.7 A or B analysis, and they merely assumed that because Mr. Files represented two clients, one regarding one matter and another regarding a different matter, that somehow that in and of itself was a conflict of interest.
So you're claiming then that you can represent several different clients who may have adverse interests to each other as long as those representations consider different matters?
I think the rules specifically call for that. If you take a look at the comment section under Rule 1.7, especially subcomment paragraph 17, you'll find that there is guidance for the attorney to determine whether or not the representation does in fact pose an actual conflict of interest. And in this case, all Mr. Files was hired to do with regard to the Royal Homes litigation that remained to be done at the time that the loan was made was to continue on with the appeal. So there was nothing other than that that needed to be done. So as to that matter,
Did the loan enable the client to continue with litigation because now he had some assets?
Well, that raises the issue of whether or not it's prohibited with respect to champerty and maintenance principles.
So if you were to have given this loan directly, that would have been champerty, correct? No doubt about that?
No. What I think would have made it champerty in our position is that were it contingent upon the outcome of the case or that the payment itself was somehow contingent, then that would
be. Do our rules allow loans to clients that are only illegal if they depend on the outcome of the case? I thought we had a flat prohibition of loaning your clients money.
Well, that's exactly what didn't occur in this case.
So if your wife loans the money, that's okay. But if you loan the money, it's champerty.
Well, under certain circumstances, it could be. But I think the bottom line here is that you have to take a look at the terms of the loan. There was a recourse loan. This was not a non-recourse loan, as appears in the Rankman decision. So I think the key here is that there is no express finding by the panel of three key elements that would impose that would show that there was a violation of any of the rules. And the first is there's no evidence of any kind that it shows that Joanne Files used Mr. Files' money to make the loan. And I think that's the key in this case, is that the obligation under Rule 1.8E is that the attorney not make or guarantee the loan. And Mr. Files explained that to Mr. Robinson and said, I can't make this loan, and therefore Joanne Files made the loan. But there is no evidence whatsoever that Joanne Files used Mr. Files' money to make the loan. So we're now in a situation where we don't have any evidence of a violation under Rule 1.8E. The panel knew that, and so what they really found was, and if you read the decision, it was that the mere arranging for the loan became the basis for the finding by the board of that violation.
Counsel, I thought there was some unresolved question of proof as to where the money actually came from.
I don't think that there was, and I think this court won't find it either. The only testimony was that Mr. Files did not use his money. And so that ties into this whole problem that you get into.
There's a question of backing that up with bank records, and those were not presented?
Oh, no, they were. They were. And there was no evidence found at any time to contradict what Mr. Files testified to. And so the panel made an express finding that he testified truthfully. And yet, at the end of the day, they say he failed to disclose a material fact. Well, number one, the decision doesn't even tell us what the material fact is. So if you resolve that ambiguity in his favor, you're left with saying, well, Mr. Files did not tell the panel the exact source from which Joanne Files drew her money to make the loan, and so therefore you did not disclose that material fact. That's all you can draw from that opinion. And we say under
those— Do you think that was unreasonable for the panel to ask for that information?
I certainly do, because once Mr. Files said it wasn't my loan or it wasn't my money that made that, then does that not shift the burden back to the relator to say, well, we have subpoena power and we're going to find that information? And they did. And they attempted to do so, and they couldn't find it. It wasn't there because Mr. Files told them the truth.
All right, getting back to the disclosure to the clients about the relationship, am I to understand that when the loan was made, it was stated specifically and directly to the clients that Mr. Files did not represent them in this matter?
Yes, that's correct.
Not I'm a limited counsel or I'm a special counsel, I'm not a general counsel.
No.
They were actual language, because I don't see that readily, that where it's found that he actually stated in writing to them that I am not your counsel for the purpose of this loan.
I think if you take a look at the closing statement, you'll see that underneath his signature, Mr. Files says, attorney for Joanne Files.
Mr. Wisniewski, though, the rule does say that there shall not be continued representation of more than one client unless each affected client gives informed consent, confirmed in writing. Do we have that in the record, where the clients, each of them, are giving informed consent as to this arrangement?
No, we do not. The reason for that is because there's no actual conflict, neither is there a substantial risk that Mr. Files would fail in his duty to either client as a result of the fact that he represented the two clients, but in different matters.
Do you find it appropriate that your client prepares the promissory note and as consideration it is the cause of action assignment to the lender, his wife? Do you see any conflict in that?
No, I don't. And that's Mr.
Do you
Files.
Think that's appropriate conduct for lawyers?
Yes, I do.
So lawyers could have friends or relatives loan money to their clients and then assign the causes of action back.
Assignments of action, according to my understanding, are mere choses in action, and as long as they do not constitute a champerness or a maintenance a posture, that those are freely transferable. So I don't see the difference between whether the assignment was made to a assignee named Joanne Files or to an assignee called Huntington Bank. I fail to see that has anything to do with it. It's not a material fact.
Mr. Wodniski, you have totally absorbed the minutes that you wanted Mr. Files to present, so we will move on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kavanaugh?
Chief Justice O'Connor, Associate Justices, may it please the Court. My name is Patrick Kavanaugh. I represent the relator of the Toledo Bar Association in this matter. The relator believes that there are three issues presented in this case. The first is whether the board's conclusion was correct in that respondents arranging a loan from his wife to his client violated Rule 1.8E as well as Rule 8.4A. The second issue presented is whether the board's conclusion is correct that the respondent's representation of a client during pending active litigation at the same time that he was representing his wife in the loan transactions violates Professional Rule 1.7A as well as Professional Rule 1.7B. The third issue is whether the board properly considered aggravating and mitigating factors. One of those factors was that the respondent gave contradictory testimony at the panel hearing about bank accounts. If I might start with point three, the aggravating and mitigating factors, I would like to point out that the Toledo Bar Association has not changed its recommendation. The recommendation from the Toledo Bar Association is a one-year suspension, all stayed, on condition of six additional CLE hours in ethics and law office management. The board recommended one-year suspension with only 6 months' stay. If I could then now focus on the first issue, I think the argument basically presented by the—
Let's stop with the last one. So sure. You're here telling us the penalty ought to be 1 year all stayed.
Yes, sir. And I believe that is consistent with the closest case that we could find on the issue, which is Cleveland Metro Bar Association versus Podor. And that case had a one-year suspension, all stayed.
That also involved a loan from a Cleveland lawyer through his office to a client.
Correct. The lawyer in that case used a corporation that the lawyer had control of to actually fund the loans.
Thank you.
So the only difference would be that the panel felt Mr. Files was changing his story from start to finish. Would that be the only difference?
The panel had the same recommendation. The board, I think, I don't know why the board came up with a harsher sanction, other than they seemed to be indicating that there was a lack of cooperation that created a harsher sentence.
Okay. And do you feel there was lack of cooperation?
I feel that there was a material failure to disclose information about bank accounts. But as the relator, I had the burden of proof as to tying the money to Mrs. Files. I was unable to do that. But there was contradictory testimony. At first, in an interrogatory, the respondent said, I had none. When I asked what bank accounts do you have, personal and business, he said, had none. Then at the panel hearing, he testified about how he had separate accounts from his wife. His wife's accounts were separate from his accounts. When cross-examined about, I thought you had no accounts, he changed his story to say, well, there were only law firm accounts. I didn't have any personal accounts. I misspoke.
Didn't Mr. Files used to represent David Palmer?
I don't know, sir. It's probably before.
What? Okay.
Probably before my time.
Okay. Well, that experience might have caused him to disperse his holdings. Might not have. I mean, I read here, it's hard to believe that a lawyer doesn't have personal bank accounts. But if that lawyer had represented David Palmer, who also doesn't have personal bank accounts or personal assets, That it's more plausible to believe that it's possible that Mr. Files, isn't it? Given the unique circumstance of that attorney-client relationship, which went south, just putting it mildly.
I'll take your word for it, sir. So I guess this relates back to the first issue, which is whether there was a violation of Rule 1.8E. I think that the respondent is basically saying that as long as it wasn't my money, I did not provide financial assistance to a client. I don't believe the ethical rules define what is and what is not financial assistance. The board thought that it should be a violation of 1.8E. It did not cite any authority, however, for its finding. There are not a whole lot of ethical cases, disciplinary cases, that have to do with loans being arranged by lawyers for clients. I think the Bar Association has probably cited all of them.
Counsel, it's not so much the lawyer arranging a loan for his client. I'm sure that that happens often when lawyers help their clients obtain loans for a variety of purposes. The problem, from my perspective, is the money comes from his wife. There is a conflict between who the attorney is representing in this negotiation. There's no disclosure that is, you know, put forth on the record, and in a knowing consent by the parties to say, we know that this is a potentially conflictual situation, and we're going to waive any problems that come down the road. In fact, he had to sue his former client in order to receive this money. There's a discussion that, well, he really wasn't my client at the time because there was a verbal settlement, and then the loan happened after that, and yet there was an appeal that was pursued. It's pretty fast and loose with what the details were in this entire situation in the lending of the money, and I think that that's what is troubling here. It's not trying to find cases where lawyers have made arrangements for financial backing or some sort of financial arrangement. It's the conflict of interest that I think is very troubling here, and the fact that on a technicality, well, it wasn't my money, it was my wife's money. These people never met his wife, according to the record that's before us. It's clearly this lawyer is the conduit to this arrangement and orchestrated the entire process. And now to set up this wall is very troubling, very troubling.
Well, I would agree with you, Your Honor. And I really don't think there is a legitimate question as to whether there was a conflict. I think that the reasoning presented by the respondent is that if you sign a contingency fee agreement and I say I'm only representing you in X case, there can't be a conflict. Basically, he's saying the client had to figure it out for himself whether there was a conflict. I think there's an attempt to put the burden of disclosure of the conflict on the client. Instead of the lawyer.
The client has to figure it out for themselves. Like, wait a second, what am I getting myself into?
Correct.
And here you've got two parties on one side, the attorney and his wife, who stand to benefit from the arrangement. And on the other side, you have someone who may very well be in the dark about maybe this isn't what should be happening. Maybe I am getting myself into a situation that may be a detriment to me. But clients aren't that sophisticated oftentimes, and that's why we have rules for attorneys to have to make disclosures to their clients. And it's always a better practice to disclose on the err on the side of caution as opposed to trying to make your clients figure it out.
Mr. Kavanaugh, Rule 110 talks about imputation of conflicts of interest, general rule, and it talks about law firms. Should we go so far as to talk about a per se rule of conflict, inter-family conflict of interest? I mean, I know that the rule relating to conflict of interest seems to suggest that everyone knows what we're talking about. But you heard opposing counsel say, you know, in a specific situation, the spousal relationship may not necessarily be a conflict in and of itself. Do you want to comment on that?
I don't know that I can comment on that other than I think that Rule 1.7a is fairly clear. 1.7a says a lawyer's continuation of representation of a client creates a conflict of interest if the representation of that client will be directly adverse to another current client. That's exactly what happened here. The client wanted a loan. Mr. Files arranged that. The client came in the next day and was presented with a check from Mrs. Files. Actually, there were two loans, but on the first loan, he was presented with a check from Mrs. Files. He didn't know who the funder was of the loan until that moment. There was no negotiation between Mrs. Files and the client. So there clearly is a conflict of interest at that moment.
If instead of having the check from Mrs. Files, the check had been from Fifth Third Bank, would you be taking the same position?
If Mr. Files also drafted the promissory note, if Mr. Files also represented Fifth Third Bank in that transaction, yes, we would.
Okay, so it's not the fact that we're talking about the spouse of the attorney.
Correct.
That's not the point that you're trying to make.
Correct.
Okay.
But that also is a point that you take, you get, I mean, seems to me that not just that he was the attorney for her, but that it was his spouse that he got the money from. You don't see that as a conflict in and of itself?
I do believe that is a conflict. I believe that is why, I believe that Rule 1.8 was designed to, which, if you look at 1.8, it leads all the way back to this maintenance and champerty common law doctrines. And I believe that the rule was intended to address a situation like this, where you have an attorney and the attorney's spouse being involved in a transaction like this. I don't believe that the courts want to condone or authorize that type of a situation. If there are anything else, I would be happy to answer any more questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Files, I will give you a minute.
Really look at the record, I think you'll find that, in actual fact, this is one of these attitude adjustment situations. I had a great deal of dispute with the opposing counsel during discovery, in that he submitted a demand for production of documents which was not anywhere as close to what was required by the rules of civil procedure. When I pointed that out to him, he said, well, you're required to cooperate, and therefore get the answer in right now. And that had to do with bank records. Well, he had subpoenaed the bank records. He had subpoenaed the bank records from Huntington and from, I think it was Huntington, anyhow. He found nothing to support his belief that it was my money that was loaned to the client.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that that's given. It's not your money. It was your wife's money. You still maintain that you had no conflict in arranging it from your wife and in representing your wife while you were representing these other parties.
Absolutely not. Keep in mind that representation had to affect my representation of him in the tort case against Royal Homes. And that had already been settled. At that point in time, there was a settlement agreement read into the record in the trial court.
But didn't you continue to argue about the meaning of the settlement agreement, and didn't you file an appeal on the settlement agreement?
Appeal, which I was successful with.
That doesn't mean your case is over, then, if you're still appealing for that same client. Your
representation is not over. No, because the appeal had solely to do with the trial judge ordering my clients to sign that abomination prepared by opposing counsel, which placed all kinds of additional obligations upon them. I'm talking about both Mr. Robinson and the other client, to do things which they had no obligation to do and was not included in. And you've got a copy in the record of the agreement read in the record at court about the communications between myself and the other counsel. And there was never any advice by me or statements by Mr. Robinson that he did not want to complete the settlement. And all we said was, we will not sign that, or I recommended my client not sign the drafted agreement, settlement agreement, which deviated significantly from the settlement agreement read into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Files. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our opinion.
Thank you.
We will. Marshall, would you adjourn court?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session.